Resume the council meeting and call the roll, please, Carla.
Fritz?
Here.
Fish? Saltzman? Novick?
Here.
Hales?
Here. Okay, and we have two items on this afternoon. Why don't you read them both together, please?
Item 110, accept the report on the 2014 federal legislative agenda. And item 111, accept the report on the 2014 state legislative agenda.
So let me set the stage for this and then call up our team to present. As you all remember, we had a good session here in November to develop ideas for our legislative agenda. We then also got queued up both by my recent participation in the U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting and the President's State of the Union speech last night. In both cases, there was really an emphasis in our discussion with cabinet secretaries and in the president's speech about how this administration understands that cities are going to be the implementers of a lot of key changes in our country, and that the U.S. Federal government should be a good partner for us. We can't necessarily count on the U.S. Congress to move as quickly as we need them to in some cases, so where they can and where they have the authority, this administration is going to try to find ways and means to get things done with us sooner rather than later. It was great to hear the Secretary of Labor specifically praise our sick leave ordinance. That was really fun, and we should all be proud of the fact that we're a model to the country once again, and again, developing policy at the local level that perhaps should be federal policy but isn't yet. Today we've got both of these agendas in front of us, as well as I want to add an additional item to the list, which is that there's going to be a major request from OHSU to the state legislature for really a game-changing investment in the economy of the city. But let me bring Martha and her team up to make the presentation, and we can take it from there.
Great. Thank you, Mayor and Commissioners. For the record, Martha Pellegrino, Director of the Office of Government Relations. Very pleased today to bring you both of the reports for the 2014 federal and state legislative agendas for the city. And with me today to present first the federal agenda is Niels Tillstrom, Senior Associate of Intergovernmental Affairs. So I'd like to begin today with just a few brief comments on the process that got us to this point, applicable to both of the agendas. And that process began back in August when we began soliciting ideas from offices and bureaus. Then we also created opportunity for public comment and public input into the agenda in a little bit different way than we've done before. We had set up a comment line and an email address, so any of members of the public that had some ideas that they would like us to bring to Salem or Washington, D.C. Could do so. Also, a couple weeks back, we hosted a successful Advocacy 101 session for about 60 community members to give them some tools and training about how to become good public advocates and had hand-grade representation. Both of those things we did in conjunction with both the Office of Neighborhood Involvement and the Mayor's Office. So since Council met back in November, we have worked to refine these drafts and have also conducted some extensive outreach to legislative offices as well as higher ed partners and community groups and business organizations to try to find some potential alignment in some of our requests and their requests. And I think you'll find that in the versions before you now. So turning first to the federal agenda, what you have in front of you very closely mirrors what was discussed in November. There's a few changes I will just quickly point out. Two items that you asked to be elevated to the priority list were the support for federal education funding and federal education policy, and also support for the Community Parks Revitalization Act. You'll see that those are now top-line items in the federal agenda. You'd also asked for the reauthorization of the Superfund tax be included as part of the top-line Superfund cleanup item. And also, transportation reauthorization includes streamlining of the Small Starts program, inclusion of funding for urban circulator, funding for orphan highways, and also an acknowledgement of the health benefits for transit and active transportation. So all of those have been amended in this draft. So structurally, structure remains the same as in prior years. There are top seven items, beginning with the Portland Harbor Superfund cleanup, and then organizes topics by other topic areas. In the policy positions section of the report, there are a few additions, again, based on feedback we received during the work session. That would be the funding and helping with the James Beard Public Market. In the healthcare section, there is a new issue indicating support for behavior therapy for autism as part of the Affordable Care Act. And then lastly, on the final page of the report, there is support for the Employee Free Choice Act. So that is just a quick overview of the changes since the last time you visited this document. And maybe at that point I'll stop and take any questions or comments on the federal agenda.
Okay. Questions, comments, revisions, reactions to the federal side of the list?
This is just a comment. And, you know, I'm old and pragmatic, so I'm not going to offer an amendment to knock it out. But
technically,
you're the youngest member. Yes, right.
My apologies for any inferences. But the support for the EB-5 program, mm-hmm. which basically means if you spend $1 million in the right place or $500,000 in a really right place, you can get a visa, it rather depresses me. I mean, I was looking at an old poem, and the lady in the harbor says, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me." And she doesn't say anything about $1 million for investments in one place or $500,000 in another. And I realize I've been told this is PDC's top priority, and I'm not going to raise too much of a ruckus, but I will state for the record that it depresses me to have this in our agenda.
And Commissioner Novick, I had similar thoughts. So I'm going to be deferring to the mayor on another item later. So like you, I'm deferring to PDC. But I'm glad that we do have overall immigration reform as a top priority. I think probably most people in Portland would prefer to have immigration policies that are rational, make sense, and are enforceable, rather than the mishmash of things that we have now, which are none of the above.
Yeah, I agree with those statements. And I think this is a case of real politic with bad policy, mm-hmm. rather than getting to where we would like to be as a country with a little more congruity with our values. But while the EB-5 program exists, it does make sense for us to make the most of it.
Mm-hmm. For the record, I did not come in under the EB-5 program.
Were you tossed by any tempest on your way here?
I came because at the time they allowed nurses to be. There was a shortage of nurses. So I got in because I was a nurse, not because I was married to an American. In fact, if I had not been a nurse, I would have had to have stayed out of the country for 10 years before coming back, because I had the misfortune to be a legal immigrant on a student visa, falling in love with an American citizen, and that's not allowed under the current laws.
One more thing that ought to get fixed at the federal yes. level. So let's move on to your presentation about the state agenda, and then we'll take public comment if we have any here today. Thanks, Nelson.
We're going to do a little switch out here of our experts. So at this point, I'm inviting up the rest of the state team. To my left is Dan Eisenbeiss, State Government Relations Manager, and to my right, Andy Smith, Senior Associate, and Elizabeth Edwards, Associate. Not here, but really worthy of recognition are the other members of my team, Amy Jolkowski and Leslie Kelly and Hector Miramontes, all of which have contributed substantially to get us to where we are right now, and just want to say thank you to that. So turning to the state legislative agenda, again, these items are substantially the same to what we brought you in November, with a couple of notable exceptions. We added a section on rural partnership per the request of Commissioner Saltzman that now has two bills. One is an effort led by the Oregon Food Bank to give local farmers a tax credit for food donations. The other is support for a pilot program through Business Oregon to support rural entrepreneurship. And taken together, those items are going to help to address issues of food insecurity and economic recovery in parts of rural Oregon, but will have benefit for the whole state. 2008. We also remove the reference to sidewalk management in the preemptions area, partly because there will be no legislation in 2014, and partly I think there's some question about whether characterizing as a preemption is the right way to characterize it. So it didn't seem in that way that it really belonged there. So other than that, a number of these items you've seen before, they were things that you all wanted to see get done in 2013 and are still on the list for 2014 and are going to require some additional effort. But other than that, I think I can open it up for questions, comments.
Can I, with respect to rural partnerships, is this something that Commissioner Saltzman has raised in his capacity as our representative to the League of Cities, or is this have another genesis?
I think partially, yes. We have been incorporating issues really of primary importance to rural Oregon probably for 7 or 8 years now. And I think Commissioner Saltzman believes our foundation of being able to use the city's resources to lobby of things for primary importance of rural Oregon makes us better partners at the legislature. And so I think there is some connection there, but also I think his own interest is seeing us take a much more statewide view of lobbying.
And Martha, we're reading lots of different, sometimes conflicting accounts of what's likely to happen during this session. Based on what you're hearing and seeing, can you give us a little primer on how you see this session unfolding?
I can try, although the reason you're seeing different accounts is nobody really knows. And so I will give you my best estimation, and that is we're going into a 35-day short legislative session, which means there really is not a lot of time to introduce new policy or work through really big or complicated issues. I think a lot of what we'll be seeing are technical fixes from the 2013 legislative session. We will also be seeing, you've been hearing about, there's a couple big projects where they have been working over quite some time to get support for. We'll see a vetting of those things. But really, the amount that can get done and the timelines they've set are things that have been pretty thoroughly vetted at this point. And then we will also be, we've seen the first set of bills of the two big sets to be dropped pre-session. And it does look like we're going to be playing some defense because things do move very quickly. And there's always bills that propose to take away authority from cities or change up funding models. So we will be spending some time defending cities' interests against those things.
And based on what we've been reading about the CRC, what's your assessment about whether the CRC is going to survive this session?
I think it's going to be, I think it has a tough road, but that is something that, the governor just indicated and reiterated his support. The speaker has been a staunch advocate, and so with those leaders and with the project team, they're still trying to make their case. The difficulty and the main difficulty seems to be about the issue of it being a mainly Oregon effort, and I think that's where there's some reluctance. So that dialogue and those issues will be playing out in the coming session.
And I think Commissioner Novick may have some comments on this one as well. I think it's certainly worth our conversation with our legislative delegation making some mention of this, and that is, I think now at this juncture, regardless of the City of Portland's position on the project itself, I think we do want to urge the legislature to respond to the governor's call and decide this session, because we do have an increasing interest in a 2015 legislative package on transportation funding. And for this now 10 years of planning to continue any longer will really start to get in the way of that work. And then secondly, I think the credibility of government is at risk for a project that has spent as much as it has for as many years as it has to be carried on any longer. So whether you love the project or you hate it, I think this is a good time for them to decide. And I want to encourage them as colleagues and friends that call the question and answer it, please.
And the only comment I'll add to that is that the discussion of the CRC recently reminds me of the scene in The Princess Bride when that they're asking Billy Crystal to revive the Man in Black, and he said, well, we need to determine whether he's all dead or mostly dead. And Inigo Montoya, I think, asks, you know, what does mostly dead mean? And Billy Crystal says, well, if you're mostly dead, maybe you can be revived. All dead, we go through your pockets for loose change. And it does strike me that if the CRC is, in fact, all dead, then we should go through its pockets for loose change. I met with a group of legislators a couple of weeks ago when somebody asked me what I had to say about the CRC, and I said, well, CRC is above my pay grade, but I will say this. It seems to me that the legislature decided last year that it should spend $450 million on transportation projects in the Portland area, and I hope that if there is no CRC, they will still spend $450 million on transportation projects in the Portland area.
Love it.
We can hope. Okay. Any other questions or comments for the team? Now, I do want to make sure that we have in front of us before we take testimony that we have suggested, I have suggested, an additional item for the list, and that is that OHSU is going to be making a request for $200 million towards the big hill they have to climb to meet the Knight Challenge. As we all know, the Knight Challenge is a $500 million charitable grant that is conditional on matching funds being raised by OHSU by one means or another, public, private, philanthropic, wherever they can, whatever pockets they can go through for change, but big change. I'm persuaded that this is a really important decision and something that we ought to support on a couple of counts. One is the obvious economic development count. When we designed the plan for the South Waterfront, we hoped that it would become not only a home for OHSU's expansion, but also a place of biomedical business growth in the city. Frankly, up to now, that really hasn't happened. But if you look at what comes with the Collaborative Life Sciences Center, and if you do, as I have, start talking with people that are in that sector, we were visited yesterday by a national development firm that builds laboratory space in just this kind of setting, who frankly didn't pay any attention to Portland before, but now is paying attention. I think we're really about to turn that corner. And those are all really valid economic arguments, I think, for why $200 million from the legislature plus $800 million from other sources is really going to pay dividends for Portland. But on a human level, I think it's a worthy investment for our state to support an institution that's done so much already and is poised to do a lot more for the deadliest disease in the country. And we've all been touched by cancer in our families, and OHSU has made a huge difference. I have friends who are alive today because of Gleevec, and I think if they are supported in this research work, it will be great for the economy of Portland, but a whole lot of people will live longer lives because of that work, and that counts, you know, like the old MasterCard commercial, that part's priceless. So the $200 million is a lot of money. And it's going to be hopefully leveraged to produce a lot of benefit, but I think on a human level, it's even more valuable.
Just so, one question, Mayor, on that front, because I support this amendment. But Martha, does this compete with any other priority the council has put forward?
It does. It does not. The Ways and Means request that is in the agenda is for emergency homelessness assistance and housing assistance. This request is for capital funding, so there is no immediate competition there.
And is this any different from prior legislative actions to do capital funding for things like the life sciences building or other things that we prioritize in our backyard?
It isn't. I think that, you know, a number of our higher education partners have come forward with different projects that the city has gotten behind and part of a coalition to support. So I see this as being one of those types of projects.
Yeah, except, of course, the other difference is the mechanical one of, you know, there are projects proffered to the legislature for funding this year, next year, mm-hmm. next year, and it happens all the time. In this mm-hmm. case, there's a two-year opportunity for the leverage for the other $500 million, and perhaps Phil Knight would extend that 2 years if they didn't quite make it to $500 million in that time, but who wants to take that chance? So this is a limited duration opportunity because of the leverage with private philanthropic dollars.
You know, it does remind me that the story I told you, Mayor, once about my son's vision issues, and not knowing anything, we started by going online and just doing the research. We kept coming back to the fact that the top-rated program and the top-rated doctors were at Casey. It was a wonderful revelation that it's in our backyard. But if we as residents are learning that that's the best care facility in the country, and we continually build the brand around cancer research, cancer treatment, and OHSU's profile. That's great for people who live in this area, but it's also great for the continuing growth and progress of, I think, our largest employer. Isn't OHSU
our largest employer? So. Yeah, and I think it's hard for us sometimes in Portland to think of ourselves as a national or world-class leader. I mean, we have always been pretty modest as a city. But this will be, the overused term game changer, I really think it is that. If you look at the facilities at the Collaborative Life Sciences Center and you look at this opportunity, I think it is a game changer. As Joe Robertson, the president of OHSU, puts it, this gift, if the Knights make it, will be four times the size of the largest gift ever given to Harvard University. That's a different league than we're used to being in Portland, and I think it's a fine thing for us to have to stretch to that new understanding of where we stand in things. So I'd like to put that on the table and with the council's support, add that to the list, and then let, again, folks, if there are folks here that want to speak about the agenda, let them react to that as well.
Do you have to move it?
Yes, could you please? I will move that as an amendment.
Second.
And I think we have copies. Any further discussion on adding the amendment and having that on the table as well? Then a roll call on the amendment.
Fritz?
So, Mayor, you speak very persuasively in favor of this. I'm a former OHSU employee, and certainly I am a big fan of Uncle Phil and his philanthropic gifts to the University of Oregon and its football program. I'm somewhat reluctant to ask the state legislature to direct funding based on a philanthropic gift. It feels like one person, one entity is directing where the state should invest precious borrowing power. Mm-hmm. It does seem it will have a lot of construction jobs, which will help us continue to climb out of the recession. It has about 400 ongoing positions. But it will take away from something else. And so I'm willing to support it. I want to be alert to this being a single person pushing the state's agenda by this large gift. And just as long as we're aware that that's happening, I think that we're then able to make our decisions in the light of full disclosure. Aye.
Fish.
In light of that, I will simply say that I will not support a future amendment like this unless someone puts up the equivalent amount of money, a philanthropic match. So we'll set the bar very high. Aye.
Novick?
Well, I share and Commissioner Fritz's concern, and it's also kind of counterintuitive to me to think of anything healthcare related as an economic development driver, because I'm used to think of a healthcare cost as an economic development drag. But it is a fact that if you're on the cutting edge, I mean, for the most part, healthcare costs are not, I mean, healthcare is not a traded sector industry. It's soaking up the local money for local expenses. But if you're on the cutting edge, if you're selling a new drug, if you're getting people coming in from the rest of the country for treatments, then it does act as a traded sector industry. It draws money in from the rest of the country. And Gleevec is a good example of, I mean, Gleevec's being sold all over the place. This is only tangentially related, but one example of how healthcare can become a traded sector commodity is, I just heard this story a few months ago. The Lowe's, the national like home furnishings company, has enough employees all over the place that even relatively rare medical procedures are things they see all the time. And there's some sort of complicated heart procedure where they looked around the country and concluded that the best place to get it in terms of cost and quality was the Cleveland Clinic. So if you need that procedure and you work for Lowe's, they fly you to Cleveland and give you and your significant other, if any, two tickets to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And that's where you get the procedure done. So the city of Cleveland is getting economic development benefit from the fact that they're good, the Cleveland Clinic is good at this particular procedure. So I hope that if OHSU develops some sort of treatment for which people are flying in from the rest of the country, we figure out what they should get tickets to.
good problem to have.
An aye.
Oh, that's an aye.
Heels.
Thank you very much. Aye. Okay, thanks, team. And then we'll see if we have some folks. Another suggestion.
Sure. Thank you.
Sure.
So this morning we heard from Future Connect, and they told us that there's House Bill 4116 being proposed that will add $1 million statewide for programs like Future Connect. And I looked to where we could add something about that in this packet, and I noticed that we don't have an education piece in this priority list, presumably because most of the education funding will be done in the odd years. But to the extent that I feel like I didn't notice before that we don't have anything on education or on mental health funding. You, of course, know that these are priorities for the city, but particularly on education, where there are we need a paragraph or an introductory piece that says we support education funding ongoing increased, because although the legislature made a good start in turning around last year, by no means are there enough teachers in being paid in Oregon. Mm-hmm. So specifically with respect to House Bill 4116, but then in addition, what do you need from us in order to be able to give you the oomph to carry that message to Salem?
Great, thank you, Commissioner Fritz, and we've also been in touch with the folks at PCC about their request. So I think Council has a couple of options. I mean, one is just to give us direction to make sure that Council supports that request. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the legislative agenda in order for that to happen. So if you would like us to do that, we can partner with them. Again, we'll see about 300 bills introduced, some of which will weigh in on some requests. We can also prepare something for the report. Your point about signaling to the legislature about looking, you know, great job in 2013, that needs to continue, I think is a great message to carry forward. And I don't think that it's going to be the document that's as important as coming from you all. So I would encourage this council in every communication that you're going to be having in the next few weeks with members to give them credit for the progress they've made, but to say this needs to be carried forward, and several of our members are actually in a really good position to do something about those things. So I think your advocacy is as important than, if not more important than actually what we put on paper necessarily in front of them. But I think there'll be some opportunities to reinforce that message in the coming weeks.
Good. Might be good, though, to have us on record as supporting that bill.
Right.
There's a council consensus, I think, that's definitely something we do want to support.
Right.
Good. Thank you. Appreciate that reminder.
Sure. Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
All right. Now, do we have some folks signed up to testify?
Yes, we do. We have two people. Please come on up. Mike Strickland and Daniel Sandini.
Good afternoon. Come on up.
I would like to ask since there's only two people to testify, could I have 6 minutes, please?
Well, we'll give you a little extra time, but if you have a written statement, you might want to leave it. So,
okay, if I could have like a 30-second notice on when to wrap up. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, thank you. I'm Michael Strickland. Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, Assembled Council. I live in Milwaukee now, but I lived in Portland for 8 years. I still work in the city and may very well move back in the future. I come before you today to specifically address the public safety aspect in the state legislative agenda packet, which calls for supporting the universal background checks on those who want to transfer a firearm to their neighbor or friend. First off, I would ask any proponent of the universal background check bill to explain to the public how it would stop two criminals with malicious intent from making a firearms transaction in a dark alley somewhere, or how it would stop a grandfather from passing down his old rifle to his grandson. How would anyone know that background checks were not being conducted on such deals? My second issue with this is the fact that the city is complicit with the blatant violation of the already existing background check laws. Last May, the mayor and several officers with the PPB assisted Ceasefire Oregon with their illegal gun show, which consisted of more than 25 firearms being transferred without any background checks being conducted, a clear violation of ORS 166.432 and 438. You may remember, Mr. Hills, when I asked you about this on camera as you were leaving the event, you were very defensive and at a loss for words. You told me to go talk to the police. I already had talked to the police, and they told me to leave the property after I began to cite ORSs. As I understand it, as mayor, you are the police commissioner. So I would ask, if you are willing to turn a blind eye to already existing laws, isn't it kind of a double standard to want more laws regarding the same topics? Thirdly, I would ask Ms. Pellegrino to cite her source for her claim of 442 deaths in 2012 due to firearm sales in the state. According to the FBI website, there were 92 murders or manslaughters in the state in 2012. In fact, over the past 20 years, we have seen a decline across the nation in murders and violent crimes. Society in general is evolving, becoming more peaceful. This is despite the mass proliferation of firearms during this 20-year period. Furthermore, 2013 saw the fewest murders in Portland since 1971, despite the massive boom in firearm sales that took place at the end of 2012 and the first few months of 2013. One has to ask themselves, with the drop in crime, is another law really necessary? Fourthly, there were just over 2,000 people who failed their background check at gun stores in the state last year. As I understand it, it's illegal to even attempt to procure a firearm if you are a felon or if you know in some other way that you would be disqualified. I would ask Ms. Pellegrino or any other proponent of the bill to tell me how many of those 2,000 plus or 1.8 million nationwide were prosecuted. If the current system isn't even capable of pursuing the current offenders, how will it handle a theoretical massive increase for failed background checks? In closing, after hearing the information I've presented, if people still support the universal background checks, then one can only reach two conclusions about such people. Either you are willfully ignorant and closed-minded, sticking your fingers in your ears, going, la, 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 I can't hear you, or you just want to pass a feel-good resolution. So you think you're doing something good, so you think you're helping people. That's your objective, then congratulations. But it isn't going to help anyone, and it isn't going to stop anyone from being hurt or killed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let me just ask you a question, sir.
Yes, sir.
I don't think we've met, and I'm a little confused. So is your view that it's not strong enough or it's not necessary?
It is not necessary.
And do you have a view generally about background checks?
I think the very notion of background checks, if someone supports it, then that means they presume people are guilty. Having a presumption of guilt about someone where they then have to prove their innocence sets a very dangerous precedent. For example, the DUI checkpoints that you hear about in the news every now and again that people set up. I haven't seen it much around here, but I've seen it in other states. You know, they're just randomly pulling people off to the side of the road, pulling them out of their cars, making them submit to these checks without any reasonable suspicion that they've done anything wrong.
Do you have written testimony you're going to share with us?
I have the testimony here written down, if you would like a copy.
If you can leave it with the clerk, if you wanted to. And are you here as an individual or as an or representing an organization?
I'm as an individual.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much. Yeah, if you could leave us a copy, that would be helpful.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Strickland, I think your numbers don't account for the number of accidental deaths and suicides.
Okay, well, I'm asking Ms. Pellegrino to cite her source in the legislative agenda packet that says 442 deaths.
Yeah, we'll find out the source of that number, but I think the point Commissioner Fritz has made is sound, even if the numbers aren't exactly right. We had 16 murders in the city last year and 43 suicides, I think, documented as such. So it's a huge factor. I mean, firearms are one of the ways by which people commit suicide.
Would the background checks, though, if somebody wanted to kill themselves, would a background check stop
case,
that?
Not in every case, certainly, but in some, perhaps.
Actually, New York State has one of the lowest suicide rates in the country, and it also has one of the toughest sets of gun control laws, and researchers believe there is a correlation.
I would like to see your sources on that.
Okay. I can send you that.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Okay. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Mayor Hales. And let me just start by thanking the distinguished members of the council. This is my first time being here today. As you've got beautiful chambers here, I've never been down here before. Expect
time.
To see me, I guess. That's what I'll say.
Put your name on the record if you would.
Okay, my name is Dan Sandini. I'm a video journalist, citizen journalist here in the city. And I'm a gun owner, a concealed carry person. Last year I had the benefit of being down in the State House and catching Manny Martinez. And I don't know, do any of you know who Manny is? He's a Cuban immigrant here to the United States who went through communism, the rise of communism in Cuba. And Manny testified down there. It's the biggest video on my YouTube channel, his testimony. It's 250,000 views, which I think I have the biggest political YouTube channel here in the city. And what Manny was describing, and I invite you to go look at that. It's YouTube/daylightdisinfectant if you want to go look at that video. And what Manny had to say was that the first step is this gun registration. That's the first thing that they did. And you may say that they're not going to keep a record of this, and that and people inside city offices and state offices aren't going to use these records to intimidate us. But I can tell you that that does happen, and that's going to be the first step. And I guess my next point would be is that this is the Constitution that we're talking about. This is I am not given that right by any government organization. I'm given that right by God, by God. And all of you should be ashamed for wanting to add additional legislation. I understand there are existing gun checks in place right now, and I understand that the Supreme Court has ruled that that cities and states can put reasonable checks on those things. But every additional law detracts from other resources. You are not going to stop a criminal from getting a gun. Look at the city of Chicago. Look at the high murder rates that they have down here. One of the reasons why we have such little gun violence here downtown in Portland is because we live in a state where it's easy for a citizen to go and get a gun and carry it as a concealed lesson. You could take a class in one day here in the state and do that. And that is my right that's given to me. That makes us unique individuals, different from any other beast on the planet. And the founding fathers knew and understand that. And governments should not get in the way of it. That's my point. And I will say that I resent any further additional restrictions on doing that. You know, I can go and from a friend, Charlie, we're both good guys. We both know each other downtown. Just for $100, buy his rifle from him without having any government agency put my name in a database, nothing, okay? I can go ahead and do that. That's my right as a free man, a very unique right given to us as individuals here in the United States. And I would say for someone who's a British Commonwealth citizen or for someone who comes from, you know, I lived in Germany for 8 years. I lived in Japan for a year. I've lived all over this world. And I know what people suffer through. I know that people inside Great Britain suffer with having to go to bed with baseball bats because the criminals still have guns. And I would ask you to really think. I know you're smirking and smiling, Steve Novak, but what I will say to you
is... How many gun deaths per capita are there in the United
Kingdom? Could you let me finish? Could you let me finish before you interrupt me? Would you let me finish? I know I'm out of time, but I'll take a few minutes. We're the only two people here today, okay? I would say, before you do this, I would ask you to stop and think and consider that this is the last bastion of freedom on earth. And every one of these laws stands in the way of freedom-loving citizens owning weapons and puts in place a mechanism for someone disarming the citizens, just like they did during Katrina, just like that, the legitimate citizens.
How many gun deaths per capita are there in the United Kingdom?
I don't have those facts in front of me, sir.
Okay, thanks very much.
Mr. Novick, I would propose that maybe you should move to the United Kingdom.
Okay, we'll exchange facts later. Thank you.
And I want to thank the council very much.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having us.
Okay. Anyone else that wants to testify?
That's all who signed up.
So we need to take action on these because we have a legislative session coming up next week and some communications tomorrow, I think, with our delegation. So let's take a roll call on the first one.
110, Fritz.
Federal agenda.
Oh, sorry. I didn't hear my name because I was thinking.
Sorry, talking over.
Thank you to Martha Pellegrino and your team. Every year I become more impressed with the work that you do and the careful way that you do it. And so I greatly appreciate knowing that the citizens of Portland, as well as the City Council, has such a great team. Whenever I have gone down to Salem, as I do my duty every year to follow the instructions that you give me, I always hear how great you are, and I know also that Vicky Cram and the team in Washington, D.C., and those of my colleagues who like to go to D.C., do a wonderful job in representing the city of Portland and the citizens of Portland, so thank you very much. Hi.
Fish.
I also hear about what a great job you're doing, but it's not just from your parents. There's a larger group. So, you know, as I look at the federal agenda, Mayor, there are some items in here that have very benign headings and have very benign write-ups that have potentially catastrophic impacts on us, and things like changing the ground rules on municipal tax and driving up the cost of borrowing to do infrastructure. The levy recertification, I mean, there aren't two people who really fully understand the moving pieces on this, but could have a significant impact on our community. And
and on and on. Now, on the one hand, there's some very tough issues here and with huge consequences. On the other hand, I guess we should feel better knowing that one of our senators is now going to be the chairperson of the arguably the most important Senate committee and have a big say about how we work some of these issues out. So I appreciate the way this agenda is put together, and I always look forward to the opportunity that I get annually to come to Washington with the A-team and visit our delegation. And I hear the same thing in D.C. that we hear in Salem, which is we have a wonderful team of people that brief us, get us prepped, get us to the decision makers, and we have a lot of credibility with our partners in D.C., and it's a function of a great team that we have. So thank you, and thanks for the all the hard work that went into preparing our federal agenda. Aye.
Novick?
I have recently had occasion to be thoroughly annoyed by how hard our team works and how efficient they are. I was going on vacation to Washington, D.C., and I said, you know, I could set up a meeting or two. I'd be okay. So I found myself with six meetings, including with most of the congressional delegation. But so I had to get up earlier than I expected and dress up more than I expected while I was on vacation. But I have to say it was worth it because, for one thing, I had a chance to meet with Senator Berkeley 2 hours after he broke the filibuster, so that was pretty cool. But more importantly, I had a chance to meet with Senator Wyden to talk about our critical energy infrastructure vulnerability, the fact that most the entire state's fuel supply is in a very earthquake-vulnerable section of the Willamette River, and to talk to Senator Wyden about whether he on the Energy Committee could talk to the oil companies about taking steps to ensure that we don't have a river of fire or no fuel supply when the earthquake hits, and he's been following up on that. So that's just one example of the quality of your work and Vicky's work, and I very, very much appreciate all you do and the work in preparing these agendas today.
Steve, will you yield for 1 second? Could you just state again what you said about Merkley?
I had a chance to meet with the senator 2 hours after he broke the filibuster.
All right, so this is the magic of our team, because when I was in D.C., we met with Merkley at almost exactly the time that the Supreme Court was issuing two historic rulings on equality, one having to do with the California proposition, the other one on DOMA, and it was followed by a tweet from the majority leader announcing that he was going to bring Jeff Merkley's ENDA legislation forward. So it seems like every time we go to Jeff Merkley's office, something great is happening.
Hales.
Well, I want to thank the team. You know, there's some people who might look at the current low ebb of productivity in the U.S. Congress and say, what's the use? You know, why bother to adopt the federal program at all. Bruce Katz from the Brookings Institution was here recently and is fond of saying, and I'm fond of quoting him, saying the federal government's devolving into being a healthcare company with an army. But actually, I don't think that that's necessarily a permanent condition. You know, these things do go through cycles, and it may be the case that we will have action in Congress, even if that seems like a little bit of an oxymoron sometimes right now, on some of these critical issues. And it's really important that we be present and that we have a limited, focused, but, you know, significant agenda in the, at the federal level, even if it takes multiple sessions to get to some of these issues. So I'm a believer that this is a worthwhile effort, and that as long as we're clear about the critical needs for the city and we have a congressional delegation that we can work with, and we do, then we have some influence. Doesn't mean the process, you know, is as effective as I think a lot of Americans would like it to be right now. But this is a good agenda. I'm very comfortable with what we're doing, and I think based on the meetings that we had last week, I think we have some cabinet secretaries in particular that appreciate what Portland is doing, and we'll look for ways to help back our progress here, whether by legislation or by administrative action. So thank you very much. Aye. Okay, now let's move to the state program.
Fritz.
So again, I appreciate the work and the list of projects, and knowing that you will be advocating both for House Bill 4116 and for the other high priority items on our ongoing agenda, and namely education and mental health funding. So thank you for that. I'm a strong supporter of universal background checks, and I just looked it up on my handy device here. And in 2011, there were 564 murders in the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom is about the same size in acreage as Oregon. There are 56 million people living there. there were 39 gun deaths, gun murders in that year. So in our, with our 4 million people, we have about close to the similar number of murders and more gun-related deaths. And in particular, the tragedy is that when people attempt suicide with guns, they are far more successful than when they attempt suicide other ways. And so that's one way that the background checks would be helpful in identifying folks with mental illnesses who need help rather than access to firearms. I'm appreciative of Representative Jessica Vega Peterson and Representative Lou Frederick, who gave up their time to come to our Lobbying 101 offering. They've particularly Representative Frederick has done that year after year, and his comments are always very insightful. Not only does he share my aversion to the websites that allow with one click you to send the same message that I've read 600 times before to me again, which please don't do that, that's not effective lobbying, but also when he was asked this time what one thing would he do to change and improve the legislative process, his answer was bring back public campaign financing. So I acknowledge that money in politics is a challenge for a lot of folks on all sides, and at some point I hope we get to be doing public campaign financing both at the city level and at the state level, hopefully nationally eventually. In the meantime, I appreciate your work since the last session on paid sick leave, and we'll be talking with legislative leaders tomorrow about continuing that work. My understanding is that there won't be a bill in the short session, but that we are working towards getting a paid sick leave for Oregon in the next session, and that will certainly be appreciated because the implementation here is going smoothly and people are appreciating it. As the president said in his speech last night, a mother or a father should not have to worry about missing day work to take care of a sick child or a sick parent. So thank you to the council for your work in that particular instance and for helping to set this very solid agenda. Aye.
Fish?
Commissioner Fritz, I've been talking to some people recently who have raised this concern about different rules applying depending on where they have employees. And I think that will add some momentum towards a statewide standard so that the rules apply equally everywhere.
We would be very grateful for that.
So thank you for that. And the only other thing I would add to the state legislative agenda is Steve and the mayor and I spent a little time with Speaker Kotek on Sunday, and I'm reminded that in each year she sets a couple of priorities that are her leadership priorities, and we've learned that if the speaker wants to make it happen, then it's likely to happen. So I'm hoping, Martha, you can keep your ear to the ground and guide us on particularly what's the next housing-related opportunity where the speaker is going to make it, you know, her signature piece in the next biennium, where we can start maybe participating at the committee level or whatever, because she showed us this last session what it means to have a speaker behind a controversial housing bill, and that in the instance was Section 8 discrimination. But I'm hoping she continues the momentum on something else housing-related. So thank you. Aye.
Novick?
First, Mr. Strickland, I wanted to tell you that the New York Times on February 24th, 2012, reported that New York City's suicide rate is about half the national average, about six deaths per 100,000 people compared with 11 in the rest of the country. The health commissioner, Dr. Thomas Farley, attributes much of the difference to the city's relatively strict gun laws. He noted that firearms were the chosen method in only 12% of suicides in New York in 2000, compared with 51% nationwide in 2009. In the three states with the nation's highest suicide rates, Montana, Alaska, and Wyoming, nearly two-thirds of suicides were by firearm. New Jersey, the least suicidal state, has very strict gun laws. I want to add to the thanks to our team. Thanks for all the work you do every day. And I look forward to working with you until the cows come home to close the 911 cell phone tax loophole. Aye.
Hales.
Well, thanks. This is a good package. I appreciate the discussion here today. I guess I want to say on the gun issue just briefly, I agree in part with what we heard here from a couple citizens today, and that is, frankly, as your police commissioner and somebody who gets to deal with the reality of these issues every day, I'm happy that we are less and less concerned about people of sound mind, whether they are criminals or homeowners, having to or attempting to use guns. I am more and more concerned about people who are not of sound mind. using guns. And here's the reality of those issues as it comes down to us in just four incidents. You know, as police commissioner, I get the call in the middle of the night, or I get the reports every morning about what happens. Last year, our police officers opened fire on someone with guns twice and killed them. In one case, it was a mentally disturbed man who forced his way out of Portland Adventist Hospital by making a broken telephone receiver look like a handgun and racing towards the officers, counting down at them. That was a terrible tragedy because, of course, he didn't have a gun, but they had every reason to believe that he did have one, and they shot him and killed him. In another case, a man opened fire with a shotgun on the roof of a parking garage right across the river and firing at two of our officers, who then shot him and killed him. Commissioner Novick knows this one very well. Unfortunately, we had a 15-year-old shoot himself on the Vista Bridge and fall to the ground. Just last week, well, happier news, a disturbed person with a handgun fired shots and was taken into custody with no further incident and taken in for treatment by our police officers, who are doing a better and better job of dealing with people suffering from mental illness. The more people who will fail a background check because they have serious mental illness means less incidents like the ones I just described, and that's every reason for us as a society to act. I want to particularly thank the council for your support of the OHSU proposal. You know, we are partners with other big institutions, whether it's Portland Public Schools, where we have an abiding interest in them getting to a contract soon and teaching our kids well and taking good care of our teachers, where we work with Multnomah County every day, and also with OHSU. And I think this is a good chance for us to show solidarity for them for their, I think, much increased role in the community in the years ahead. So thank you very much. Very pleased to vote aye. Thank you. We're adjourned.